It's like being port as like, you know, most people here are port, so it's a tough life being port these days, and these economic in every way. So, but imagine if you were port in the year 2320. All right. And I suppose you could imagine being a droid as well at the same time. So a droid and a port in the year 2320.
Paranoid android.
But so this poem is about a poor droid in the year 2320 and what happens to how he ends up. So it's called A Theory of Everything, or Dr. Pele's Last Case. 12 languages deep into the code, how can we hope to understand even a portion of this man's faculties? New date, 12/12/2320. Final assault submission to Solomon Street. We found the avatar's deliberately malign body struck wholesale on the face and neck. Switchwork damaged Kentish stylus and several similar attacks. Words smeared on corpse in a deliberate fashion. Cause of termination as yet unknown. He should have lived for 100 years, as per manufacturer's recommendations. A science graduate and complex hydrocarbons chemist, operating out of Massey laboratories on secondment to Inc. Industries. Report ends. What could our possible motives be, these ruthless bastards? Restart. Following autopsy, cranial damage and entrainment of the lungs appear to be cause of death. Undefined rhythms on the brain scan, purporting to be metaphoric sequences, normally associated with the imagination. End. He hung with poets, feigning human qualities. Dr. Pele left the frozen boy, heading back along the cold corridors towards his office. Perturbed but determined to keep his suspicions to himself, sensing once more the original aberrations in the vacuum. Machines will dream, he thought, and what can we do against the senseless violence of mismatched youth? Or the wiring gone wrong in a murder droid.
Very atmospheric. Wow. Brilliant. Thanks, Colin. Next up, please welcome, the hits just keep coming, Mary Cookie.
The woman who lived under Vesuvius takes a firm hold of the bread, throws it slowly towards herself, dropping slice upon slice on the table. Resin simmers on the stove, emitting little gasps, the gloop of molten stew held within an aluminium pot. Her hair is iron grey, dark maid daughters dutifully lay the table, mozzarella anointed with fat green oil, round shavings of salami, pale parma laid out on paper. She thinks of her son living in Sunless Island, where the mozzarella is scarce and never fresh. With a religious ear, she listens to news from distant places, fires raging in the Antipodes, floods in America's deep south, tsunamis in Thailand that conjure the apocalypse, while Vesuvius knows smoke signals just 5 miles to her right. And this one is about the milking man when the whales came up the river. The pod. Whales in the outer harbour frolic and feed in the embrace of coastline. At dusk, they move upriver. People stream a confluence on the footpath, grey concrete blending to the dust haze river. They move, a kind of human pod, congenial, neighbour hailing neighbour, all united in the gift of closeness to such wild creatures, yet strangely familiar. An undulation of quails swimming the umbilical river that is seeking the moon.
Next up, we're very lucky to have Connor McManus.
there's a poem in three parts, I'm just reading it straight through. It's called Strike It. 10 stories above Nord Alley, the red latticework of the triangular crane arm, chains flowing, scribes a silent arc against the grey early morning sky. A compressor roars and hisses incessantly and spews noise and black diesel fumes. Its hose is convulsing. The jackhammer farting and clinking dances uselessly like a ventriloquist doll on top of hard white concrete. A natural steel fixer with the hood of his green parka pulled up against the coal shouts for the crane. Shots of steam billow from his mouth as he curses at the Belgian driver high above. A blunt saw screams and burns timber and trips out, jamming in a heavy balk. Steel bludgeons steel as shutters are struck and cleaned and oiled, ready for reuse. Ack grows bludgeoned loose and carried across frost-drizzled steel. Steel pins and steel clamps battered, rattled free with heavy blows. Concrete type vibrated, pressure biting, timber forms, prized asunder like a chestnut shell to expose the green wrinkleless concrete column. Steam dances upward and the smell of ammonia burns my nostrils. I place my hands on the smooth concrete to feel the heat. The compressor dies and expels its bank of air with a whoosh. The hose hisses its last gasp. The whir of the crane's electric motors can now be heard as it swings overhead, laden with rusted rebar. Ladders rattle. The move is on. It's breakfast time.
Great stuff. Thanks very much. Next up, please welcome, it will be a little classic, Mary O'Connell.
You must excuse this because I just wrote it this evening in longhand, so I hope I'll be able to get through it. It's called The Strife of Brian. So much can happen in a week that following the plot can be utterly bewildering, like smoking too much pot. When things looked bad for Cowan, revolt was in the air. Brian Lenehan made a bad mistake. Backbenchers couldn't square. Too busy in the engine room, keeping the ship afloat. When it came to bashing Biffo, he stayed cautiously remote. The only one to make a stand was Martin from the south, but the putsch was too half-hearted to carry any clout. At least, by handing back the Merc, resigning on the spot, he showed he had some principle, where Hannafin had not. Mary refused to tell us how she was going to vote. She'd turned her back on Biffo, but didn't want to gloat. A gutless duck, said Miriam Lord. She kept her cushy job. Before the snap election, she'd grab the last few bob. Against the odds, Cowan held the vote, but pulled a grubby stroke. The exit of 6 ministers was way beyond a joke. The Greens were apoplectic. They hadn't been informed. A cabinet reshuffle was something that they scorned. Cowan backed down and fixed a date when voting would be held. The Ides of March, O'Dea said, was when Caesar's friends rebelled. The parameters were such Cowan knew he had to quit. Yet while bowing out as leader, he still felt he was fit to carry on as Taoiseach. But the Greens had had enough. They toppled him as leader. This time, they didn't bluff. The ship of state is rudderless and heading towards the rocks. The cabinet has splintered like a brittle tinderbox. The rot set in when the IMF came knocking at the door. Cowan sleepwalked to disaster.
and everyone is so.
Thanks so much, Mary. Next up, we have the first of many readings from Grant Burgess.
So I wrote this kind of in one sitting, and it's kind of a hopeless love poem, I guess, but I thought it was good enough. So. It's called Dawn. I don't love like I love you. Don't die, don't lay down, don't lose my footing like I lose my footing each time you creep back into my words after every pyre piled for you. I don't think when I think about you, and I always never think. Oh, I spiral in a head made for you or the world, and oh, I've made my choice. And I don't know because I know you. Oh, yeah, that hat, that dress, that ring can all come off. And I don't walk but towards you. Each cobble and each stone, yeah, they made a million hills spill over my eyes, and they don't close. Not at night when the fare is two pence. Too expensive, if you ask me, when the fee is this. I don't breathe, but to breathe in just a little more space and shrink the days that carry crosses to be never far. I don't breathe, but to hope your garden gave just one molecule of air. And I don't speak, but to speak of you and paint it up to look like words exchanged in dry cleaners steaming clean each page of paint. I don't speak, but to speak to you when you sleep like you spoke to me that last summer morning. I don't sing, but to sing of you, and sound waves never disappear. They just get quieter and quieter and quieter, but never silent. So you've heard it all, and I'm just waiting for it to dawn on you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Grant. And next up, please welcome another OVL classic, Patricia Ward.
And this one's called Winter Evening. Do sit down. I can't find words or time to describe you. Make yourself some tea. Sit down by the carriage clock that seems the hour. How do I know you? Got law, I see the final point refined to extinction. Beauty never lasts long enough to appreciate the vain glory. I love you so much it hurts. As you remain by the fire alone, I see the blood between us rise and overflow. Don't make a scene, just relax. Rest with me a while. The winter sunset grapples for attention from the stairs. Switch off the sun. Let us rise to occasions where nothing is demanded.
Thanks
so much, Patricia. Next up, please welcome Niall Harriet. This is a story to entertain you. Nothing serious. It's called Life Can Be Stranger Than Fiction. Bloody hell, now we're really up Shit Creek without a paddle, Molly. Jeez, I wish I was Ship Creek until the feckin' North Atlantic, said Molly. The huge wave had swept over the stern of the boat, nearly taking them with it. Both pairs of oars had disappeared into the cauldron of swirling water. Oh my God, what do we do now, Molly? I don't know, but we're in danger of going side onto the waves, said Molly. Christ, if we broach, we'll capsize, yelled Jill over the howling of the wind. Quick, we'll have to rig up some kind of a sail. Jill Mabry was already lashing the longboat up to the thwart as a temporary mast. We'll use our oilskin for sails, she said. The boat started to turn sideways as another enormous wave lifted it. For a moment that seemed ages to the two women, the little craft teetered on the face of the roller. Then the foaming crest surged underneath and the boat dropped down into the next trough. The women rapidly rigged up their oilskins on the makeshift mast, tying cords to the legs and sleeves so that they could hold the billowing orange waterproofs out into the following wind. The boat steadied its course again. Molly looked over at her companion's strained face and sodden fair hair, and she shivered in the driving rain. "What possessed us to take on the Atlantic in a rowing boat, Jill? We need our heads examined, so we do." Okay, time passes. Bill leaned over in the pew. "Jack, where the hell is Molly?" he whispered. "How do I know, Bill?" "You're the best man. You're supposed to sort things out for me." "Bill, this is one I can't sort out for you," whispered Jack. The images flashed back into Bill Johnson's mind of the rescue off Mizzen Head. He had been piloting the chopper, and Jack Collins was the winchman. The little boat was nearly on the surf-battered rocks when they had snatched the two women from the jaws of death. That's how he had met this infuriating young Galway woman, Molly O'Neill. On the second date, it was at the Metropole Hotel during the Cork Jazz Festival. He had known he was in love with Molly. Bill leant over again. "Jack, what if she's changed her mind?" "Bill, don't be bothering yourself, boy. Sure, don't you know the women like to keep the men waiting? This is going a bit far, though. It's an hour now. Her mobile switched off." There was a pause, then Jack whispered, "Bill, maybe you're better off without her." "What do you mean, Jack?" "Well, don't freak out, sure I won't," whispered Jack. "The day before the stag, Molly and I had a little fling, like." More time passing. "What's that you said, lady? You're about to give birth," exclaimed Eddie. "Down, that flying in crows." Molly looked pleadingly at the burly truck driver. "But the hospital over at Whoop Whoop." "Whoop Whoop? Christ's sake, that's bloody 190 miles out of my way." "Well, I'm only just starting, Mabel. We could make it, please." "And if we don't, do I look like a bloody midwife? Where the hell's your hubby or your boyfriend? Whoever put you in the pudding club, anyway?" "Jack Collins, the bastard. He left me, took off in the jeep while I was checking on the lambing. Left a note saying he wasn't cut out to be a farmer, he didn't fancy giving up bachelorhood, and that I should radio for the flying bloody doctor." Eddie shook his head. "Some fucker should be castrated." Molly nodded and mused on the various methods with which she might kill Jack. Would ground glass in its phosphorus be too kind? Yes. She would think of something even more painful. Who the hell had he gone off with this time? "Actually, look, I know you're a kind man," Molly said with a smile. "Didn't you stop and give me a lift, and me looking like a stranded whale?" "Funny bloody accent. You Irish or something?" "Yes." "Oh, here's the turn to Whoop Whoop coming up. Struth, you wouldn't read about it." Eddie swore softly to himself. "Women, bleeding women. What was he going to do if she had the nipper there in the cab, for Christ's sake?" Then he remembered that his poor mother had died giving birth to him. He swore again, then swung the big Arctic over onto the blacktop to Whoop Whoop. Time passing. The newborn baby boy lay nestled on Molly's breast. The replacement nurse, a tan, slim blonde, came in for the next shift. She stopped suddenly. "Molly, it couldn't be. Bloody well is. Jill, what are you doing here in Oz, of all people, in the outback?" "I could ask the same, Molly, but I can see. Having babies, eh?" Molly shifted uncomfortably. "Yeah, first one. I'm wrecked." "What are you going to call a little friggin' blighter?" Molly laughed. "You picked up the Aussie lingo fast. I'm calling him Bill." "After the chap you dumped at the altar, eh?" Molly smiled ruefully. "Yeah, the fellow I should have married instead of running off and living in sin with that bastard Jack." Jill's face paled.
"Jack?"
Her hand flew up to her face. "You don't mean Jack Collins from Cork?" She looked into Molly's eyes, which suddenly seemed even more dark and flashing than she remembered. Jill Mabry turned away suddenly. "Look, Molly, I'll drop in on you later," she mumbled quickly. "I'm on my rounds." She ran out of the room. Her growing intuition froze Molly's heart.
"Bastard," she shouted. "Bastard!"
Then she remembered the baby. "That wasn't meant for you, darling," she said as little Bill turned red-faced and started squalling. The next hour of Molly O'Neill's life was spent breastfeeding her baby and planning just how she could arrange an accident. so that Jack fell down and broke his crown and Jill came tumbling after.
Let that be a lesson to all of us. No matter where you go with somebody from Brooklyn, I'll be okay, thanks very much, Niall. And next up, can we please welcome Ross O'Donovan?
I was doing a bit of research online through some terms and conditions, so I came up with this. It's called Terms and Conditions for a Social Life. It's peer pressure. It's an unavoidable fact. Bullies are people that have said no to abuse and then become the very thing they despise, even bigger bullies themselves. If you're bored, you're boring. If you're careful with your expenditure, you're tight. If you're not, you're a fool, but a generous one. If you do not conform, you're banished. If you speak your mind or your own truth, then you are a liar. If you are not on a social network, social life becomes null and void. If you fail or boycott events strategically organized because of personal beliefs, then we will make your life a living hell. If you do not account for your time or whereabouts, we assure you that they will be accounted for. If you decide to quit, you will be replaced. If you demand better conditions, you're deluded. If you are living beyond your means, then you are truly living. If you are not, you are surviving or merely existing. If you have plans, ideas, then they are mine. If you have dreams, better keep them to yourself. If you are misinformed, well, that's the point. If you seek love, you will pay for it. Is that what society teaches us? Please tell me I'm wrong.
Thanks, Ross. I'm sure many people will relate to that. And we might beg Ella Tippy for one or two.
One of the problems with following Paul Casey is that I have to lower the microphone. One of the great problems. And again, I heard that poem last week and it kind of blows me away, and it really makes me sad that there's a great possibility that we may have a T-shirt in years to come from Cork was a follower of Nemo Rangers, you know. So sorry about that. This is a translation of a Scottish Gaelic song, which is a beautiful tune. The words are beautiful too, but they're very simple. And one of the problems with Scottish songs is that they use kind of nonsense syllables in between, so it kind of knocks those out in the translation. I haven't really translated the title. It's Bohanari in Brai Ranach, which means the Sheeling in Brai Ranach, which is a place in the Highlands, obviously. And the Sheeling was where people went out to watch, look after the cattle and their cows in the summertime. And of course, men and women got together. So maybe I'll try to sing the song first and then read the translation, if you'll bear with me for a long way. So it's something like this. Gore manam is medel, avante an ground garu, ferne groege marhor, is na hoger las mele, hoi ho hu ho, hoi ho hu ho. Hiri ri o hele, is hiri ri o yalo ho, ferne groege marhor, is non poger glas mawe, tu e bar van ti cwli, ien y chone mi arw, ho hi ho, hu ho, ho hi ho, hu ho. Hi ri ri o ere, gos hi ri ri o ialw ho, su e bar van ti cwli, ien y chone mi arw, Cwt y lôn yn o'ch dŵch o'r am, Heid yn o'ch rwy'n tyn hoi anach, Ho hi ho, hw ho, ho hi ho, hw ho. Hi ri ri o ele,
Sweet kisses so savage, and hair that was dashing, he bore his clothes brightly in the fanciest fashion. In the fanciest fashion, his clothes he did cherish, bought with pounds or with crowns in London or Paris. In London or Paris with crowns or what else, he sought the best gear for me to impress. For me to impress, he got the best stuff around, my belts from Dunedin, from Duncallan, my gown. From Duncallan, my gown, from Dunedin, the best. My cattle are fattest, my sheep are content. My sheep are content, and my love's in Glengariff, where he wakes me with kisses so sweet and so savage.